I'd like to relate to you a real short story by way of introduction that took place back in the 1980s. I'm not sure exactly the year, but sometime in the mid, possibly the latter 1980s. And it was took place in Big Sandy, and it involved an accident that took place on Highway 155 north, three or four blocks north of the one traffic light there in Big Sandy as you go north on 155 toward Gilmer. And at that time, there was a business located on one side of the highway, and there was a residence on the other. There was a young boy that would spend time there either with his father in the business, or he would spend time in the residence, depending on what the father's business was doing or whatever. And the issue was that the young boy decided he would cross, I believe, from the residence to the business. And as he started to make the crossing, his father observed that there's a car coming north on 155, and it, as we all know, the drive in Big Sandy, that the traffic or the speed limit starts to change and to accelerate there up to 50 miles an hour or so before you leave the city limits. So there's an acceleration taking place. The father realizes that his son is not going to make it across the highway in time to avoid being struck. And all he had time to say, and that is the father, is, "Father, help him." Or he might have said, "Father, watch over him," or "Father, protect him." And it was just a one-sentence prayer. The boy was hit by the car, and the driver pulled over and stopped. The father rushed down to check on his son. When they got there, they found that the son indeed had been hit by the car, but had no injuries. And that was, at the time, that was incomprehensible, that a car would have hit, a 10 or 12-year-old boy crossing Highway 155, and that young boy, the preteen there, would have survived in the first place, but also to have had no apparent injuries at all. That was on my mind. That story came back to mind after many years when I was thinking about the topic of short prayers. And this was certainly, evidence of one, because this was the one sentence plea for God's intervention, immediately. And that's all that there was the time for the action to take place. And one of the things that really struck me at the time and does even as I reflect on that accident is God is not bound by time in the same way that we are. And he can act at speeds that to us are incomprehensible. But certainly the answer to that prayer was delivered, practically instantaneously, and the son did receive the protection that his father, besought God for at that time. This afternoon, let's take a look at a collection of short prayers in the Bible. I need to disclaim at this point that short prayers are not the text message form of prayer. I'm not advocating that this become the method in which we pray, but to take a look at some scriptural examples of short prayers in the Bible and how they complement and supplement, much longer prayers. So before we get to the examples of short prayers, I'd like to take a look or just mention to you some of the characteristics of prayers in the Bible. And at Passover time, almost without exception in the Passovers that I've observed in my life, John 17 has always been focused on. Most cases, it's read word for word during the Passover service. The prayer of Jesus Christ to the Father right before he was arrested, and then through the events, prior to the events of that led to his crucifixion, it's a lengthy prayer, and it's a very powerful prayer, but it's not a short prayer. You know, there's also a statement in the sixth chapter of Luke, verse 12. There's the statement that Jesus Christ went out to a mountain to pray, and he was by himself, and he continued in prayer all that night. We're not really told explicitly in the scripture what he was praying about, but I think the next verse gives us an indication, and that is that, you know, the following verse says that the next day Jesus Christ chose his 12 apostles. So it's not much of a stretch, in my opinion, to think of the prayer that Jesus Christ prayed to the Father for that entire night that is recorded in the scripture, and to not think that Jesus Christ and the Father had an interactive dialogue about the selection of the 12 that would become apostles in the New Testament Church of God. Very long period of time. And it says, you know, that he prayed all night. And then when he came down from the mountain the next morning, then he made that selection of the apostles. There's also the record of the prayer of Solomon, King Solomon, at the dedication of the first temple. And I think in the New King James, it's about 41 verses that prayer takes, that King Solomon goes through, that, you know, quite a lengthy prayer to God, you know, kneeling on a raised area and with a large crowd there that were a part of that dedication of the first temple. Very lengthy prayer. You know, on the other hand, when we offer thanks for a meal, when we ask God for a blessing, those tend to be very short prayers. And unless we include something else that might be on our mind at that time, it doesn't really take that much time or that many words for us to ask God's blessing on the meal that we're about to partake of, and that we ask for the blessing on it, and we give thanks for the reception of that or the receipt of the food that we're being blessed with. I find it very interesting also in the Old Testament, there's numerous accounts, numerous records of dialogue between King David and God. And the script usually goes something like this: Lord, should I go up to such and such place and do this or that? And that's posed as the question. And we're not really told in context how long it takes for the response, but the context has an immediate response. And a lot of times it's, and God said yes or no. You know, and there's one case that comes to mind where King David is concerned that King Saul, or he wasn't really in the role of king at that point, but King Saul was, that he was, King David was anticipating that Saul would come up to a city and in pursuit of David. And so he asked the Lord specifically, will Saul come to, and then the name of the city? And the Lord's answer was, yes. That was it. And it's those particular accounts I'm fascinated by. It's almost interactive. It's almost a dialogue, an interactive dialogue between David and God in that case, where that there's the posing of a question and there appears to be an immediate answer. But it's a succinct dialogue. It's not something that appears to take, you know, hours or anything. They're just a back and forth of, should I do this? No. Or should I do this? Yes. And then the actions take place outside the scope of the prayer. You know, when we look at the model prayer in Luke 11, I find that interesting. We could say, well, it's short because it could be looked at as a topical outline. And each of the points that's made there could certainly be expanded into a very lengthy prayer or a quite lengthy prayer, depending on the circumstances that we might be in at the time, or, you know, what's going on in our lives at that particular time. But I find that interesting that the model prayer, as far as the subject matter, the topics, is quite succinct. It's very short, but it can be expanded depending on our point of view, our focus, our needs at that particular time. So there's some different characteristics of prayers that you know, that we can readily find in the Bible, from something that is an all night prayer down to, you know, King David's "Should I do this?" and then get a yes or no response, and pretty much a lot of things in between. Let's start in the New Testament in the 6th chapter of Mark, and let's look at some examples of short prayers. Examples of short prayer. Let's take a look at verse 41, Mark 6 and verse 41. And this is one of the two accounts where that a miracle takes place at Jesus Christ's request, and that thousands of people are fed. And when you look at this, you know, there's Jesus Christ is interacting with a large group of people. They're following him. He recognizes their situation and their needs, and then he chooses to take care of those needs. In verse 41, it says this, Mark 6 and verse 41, "And when he," that is Jesus, "had taken the 5 loaves, 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed, and broke the loaves, and gave them to his disciples to set before them, and the 2 fish he divided among them all." So everybody eats. Verse 44 says 5,000 people were fed. So we see quite a marvelous miracle that took place at Jesus Christ's request when he prayed to the Father, gave thanks for that, asked a blessing, and then there was no stopping of the providing of food in terms of fishes and loaves until everyone had eaten, and they took up more than they started with. So you think that's quite a remarkable example. There's the companion one over a couple of pages in most Bibles in the 8th chapter of Mark. So let's take a look at Mark 8, verses 6 and 7. Mark 8, verses 6 and 7. And this is a different account, but it's a similar situation. And then there's the dialogue there with Jesus Christ and his disciples. And back in verse 4, his disciples are saying, how can we feed this many people? We don't have the resources. We're out here in the wilderness. So, I mean, it's not like we can run down to, you know, Walmart or whatever and stock up to take care of these people. And then reading in verses 6 and 7, "So he," that is Jesus, "commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, gave them to the disciples to set before them, and they did so." They set them before the multitude. Verse 7, "They also had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said to set them before them also." And similar thing, 4,000 people were fed by that as a result of that prayer and the miracle that was then done. It's hard to imagine that that prayer took more than maybe a minute or two, you know, depending on how Jesus Christ expressed that. But, you know, he asked that blessing and gave thanks for what they had, and then the miracle took place. Let's turn forward to the 22nd chapter of Luke, and we'll look at another example of short prayer and the effect of a short prayer. Luke 22 and verse 42. Luke 22 and verse 42, and there's a companion account in the 26th chapter of Matthew that goes over the same material. We're not going to turn to that. We're just going to read the one verse here out of Luke 22, and that's verse 42. Jesus Christ basically he knows that the events leading up to the crucifixion are imminent. And these are, you know, he is down to probably hours at the most, could have been even a shorter amount of time than that. But he knows what's about to happen. And he takes James, John, and Peter, takes them a distance from the other disciples, the other apostles. He leaves them, goes on by himself, and then he prays a prayer, basically, that is encapsulated in 22:42, saying, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. That was the subject of that prayer. And he may have fleshed that out more. We're not really told the context, doesn't really say, but there, I think there's the implication that some time passes because he goes back and the three are asleep because they're tired. So he then wakes them, he goes back, he prays the same prayer three times. The subject in each case is, you know, if it be your will, Father, take this cup from me. I know what this is going to be like. You know, this is something that we have planned from the foundation of the world. We know what this is, I know what this is going to be like. And he asked that if there is any way that this could be done except that he go through this, that the Father would grant that according to the Father's will. So he always submits to the will of the Father in that, but a very short, at least as far as subject matter, a very short prayer. Let's turn over a page or so to the 23rd chapter of Luke, and let's look at two passages there. We'll look at verse 34 and then verse 46. Luke 23, verse 34. And I've heard this referred to, and you may have too, in different ways, but I've heard it said that this is the most mature statement in human history. And that's obviously a person's point of view that made that statement, but I find in any case, it is a remarkable statement that is made here by Jesus Christ. And the backstory to this from 23:34, where Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." King James said that, I think, just a little more succinctly. "For Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And for Jesus Christ, at that point, he's been on the cross for about 6 hours. And the Gospel of Mark makes it clear that the crucifixion took place in the third hour of the day, which would have been about 9 o'clock in the morning. And then from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, in other accounts, there's darkness. And then about the ninth hour is the time frame that Jesus Christ dies from, you know, the trauma and from the shock, from the blood loss and all of the beatings that he had endured. But to have been on that cross or stake, whatever it was that the Romans used, having those nails through the wrists, through his feet, and to be in agony there, and after 6 hours of that, to have a one-line prayer, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." It's a remarkable statement. And then there's the fulfillment of, Old Testament scriptures there that follows that, and they divided that as the team of four soldiers that did the crucifixion, you know, they divided his garments and cast lot. But that statement is truly remarkable as the one-line prayer to the Father. Now then over in 46, and this is in the same time frame, but this is right at the end of Jesus Christ's physical life. Luke 23 and verse 46, "And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' Having said this, he breathed his last." So that was his final expression that's recorded for us, that a request of the Father and an acknowledgement to the Father that, "Preserve my spirit, safeguard my spirit." Now then, let's go in the final set of scriptures that we'll take a look at in the New Testament to the seventh chapter of Acts, Acts 7. Many of you will recognize this as this is the martyrdom of the first deacon, one of the first seven deacons in the Church of God in the New Testament, and that's Stephen. And so there is a description of how Stephen comes to be ordained as a deacon and the circumstances that were taking place with the administration of daily things. And the apostles, you know, decide that we shouldn't be preoccupied with some of this type of work. We should be doing other things, but this needs to be done. So seven deacons were ordained, and Stephen is the first one that was mentioned. And he's mentioned as the man full of faith, and that's over in verse 5. And it talks about, you know, the deacons, and then in verse 8 it said, Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and signs among the people. So it was very obvious that God was working through the deacon Stephen, through the works that that the Father enabled and Jesus Christ enabled him to do at that time. Well, the religious authorities of the day didn't like that one bit. And so they are trying to rein in the preaching of the gospel to the world for a witness, which was beginning to take place here, at least in this localized area. And they're trying to get this under control. They're trying to get a handle on it. And so they set up some false witnesses. They provide some false testimony that inflames people, inflames the group. And so then they work their way on from verse or chapter 6 on into to 7. And so Stephen is addressing this religious council. And he has quite a remarkable history of how God started working with the predecessors to the nation of Israel at that time, going all the way back to Abraham. And he goes through that account. And then he gets down to, to about verse 51. And then he has a very confrontative statement that he makes. This, you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do you. Now, I imagine some ears got red at that point, and some temper is starting to flare at that point. And so he goes, on, and he continues to remonstrate them, and they take great exception to that. They are riled up. They says they were cut to the heart. They gnashed at him with their teeth. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it was an emotional moment for those that received this condemnation. And then he sees a vision of Jesus Christ standing at the right hand of the Father, and he says something about that, and that just sets them off even worse. And so they take him outside the city, and at the way that they did executions at times, people picked up large stones, something that they could throw, and they started to hurl these rocks at this defenseless individual. And in Luke 23:46, it says this. No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm Acts 7:59. We read 23:46 already. But Acts, the 7th chapter and verse 59. Then it says, they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God, saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. So the rocks are flying at him and they're hitting him. He's being, basically beaten to death with these stones. And he cries out to God, receive my spirit. I find that very interesting. Jesus Christ made the same request or the same statement to the Father and at the right immediately prior to his death. And then at verse 60, it says, then he, that is Stephen, knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge them with this sin. The same thing, the same type of request of the Father that Jesus Christ made as well. I never noticed that before. They're in a different order, but both of the statements are consistent with each other. Quite an example of the deacon Stephen. We're not told whether Stephen was the witness to the sufferings of Jesus Christ, firsthand or not, but certainly God used him in a mighty way. And here is mentioned here in the 7th chapter with those two very short, one line, one sentence prayers. Now then, let's if we would. Go back to the Old Testament, to the book of Nehemiah. We usually don't spend a lot of time in the book of Nehemiah. And by way of backstory, I'd like to read a paragraph from some reference material that would provide a little bit about Nehemiah, following on and contemporary with Ezra. And here's what the commentary has to say about that. Nehemiah, contemporary of Ezra and cupbearer to the king in the Persian palace, leads the third and last return to Jerusalem after the Babylonian exile. His concern for the welfare of Jerusalem and its inhabitants prompts him to take bold action. Granted permission to return to his homeland, Nehemiah challenges his countrymen to arise and build the shattered wall, and that is of Jerusalem. In spite of opposition from without and abuse from within, the task is completed in only 52 days, and that's right out of the scripture. Scripture mentions that number. A feat even the enemies of Israel must attribute to God's enabling. By contrast, the task of reviving and reforming the people of God within the rebuilt wall demands years of Nehemiah's godly life and leadership. What I find very interesting about the style in which Nehemiah wrote was there will be, in some cases, very detailed material. There's something where he mentions by name, you know, person after person after person, cases he has, almost not a genealogy, but a roster of all of the people that worked, you know, on the reconstruction of the wall. And then interspersed with that, he'll have a personal thought. And I don't know, and I looked at four different commentaries, and they were no help as to whether this prayer was spoken and then recorded for us, or if it was a written prayer that is included, you know, in the text as he was writing it. I'm not sure, you know, which it is. And in one sense, it doesn't matter, because they certainly, I think all of the commentaries acknowledge that what we are about to read, each of these is the prayer of Nehemiah. So let's start in, by way of background, you'll notice there's a fairly lengthy prayer in the first chapter where that Nehemiah hears from someone that has been to Jerusalem and returned to Babylon, or to the Babylonian Empire where Nehemiah was. He's heard about how things are going, and that prompts Nehemiah to pray this fairly lengthy prayer. But what I want to do is focus on the second chapter in verse 4. I find this very interesting. So he is the cupbearer to the king. And some commentaries will say this was a position of honor to the individual that was noted as the cupbearer, and that the cupbearer had the capacity and the knowledge to select special wines and things like that and to provide that to the king. I think there's also, even though it's not recorded, I think there's also the case in history where there were individuals that were selected to taste the wine before the king received it, so that if there was any poison or anything wrong with it, that would be known by the effect on the person that was serving rather than the king taking the first drink. We don't know, and I certainly don't know which this was. But as part of this role of cupbearer, Nehemiah comes into the presence of King Artaxerxes, and the king asks him a leading question right out of the gate. He says, "Why is your face sad since you're not sick?" And apparently it was not customary to show up in front of the king in any kind, anything but a happy mood or the expression of happiness and contentment. So the king basically asked him that question. And the thing to remember about kings and emperors at this level is you could be executed instantly at their whim or whatever they wish. They had absolute power at that point. So if they were displeased, then you lost your head, or you would be executed, basically either on the spot or immediately taken out and done away with. So there's the dialogue here, Nehemiah replies, and then he says this in verse 4, "The king said to me, 'What do you request?'" So here is an emperor of a vast empire of nations, the same that is referred to elsewhere, and I don't know if there were 127 provinces, that King Artaxerxes managed, or if that was a different, a Babylonian ruler, but a vast amount of territory, a large number of people. You're standing there in front of him, or Nehemiah is, and he puts you on the spot and says, "What do you want? What's your request?" Look at what it says right after that. So I prayed to the God of heaven. It doesn't say what he prayed, but I would bet you he's praying for wisdom. He's praying for forbearance. He's praying for acceptance by this emperor who could say, kill him, and he's dead. And so in that circumstance, you know, he said, so I prayed to the God of heaven, you know. And, you know, on a much lower scale or a much smaller scale, you know, how many of us or how many of you have been in a situation where perhaps you're at work, the phone rings, and you get one of those lovely messages that goes something like this. I want you to be in the conference room in 5 minutes. We've got such and such to go over. And so here's who's going to be there. And so there are those long walks down the hall. And oftentimes there's a lot of praying that takes place in the hallway silently as your way is being made down to the conference room. There are a number of businessmen here in the audience. And I'm, without a doubt, I would imagine there have been cases where unexpectedly a very upset, important client shows up and has an issue that they want addressed right now. Probably there are some prayers that go up for wisdom, for forbearance, for understanding, to hopefully get through this without, you know, damaging a business relationship. And then we have all kinds of other things. You know, you get confronted, you know, over this or that. You know, most of you probably had this happen to you. Right out of the clear blue, someone asks you a difficult theological question. You know, that when that's happened to me, I usually don't have any trouble but ask for asking for wisdom and for, you know, for the correct way to handle this and the right attitude and the right spirit in a non-offensive way. And, you know, you've got just a few seconds to make that request, you know, known to God, and hopefully you will get an immediate response. But I think about that when I see that sentence there at the end of 4. So I prayed to the God of heaven. I imagine he was really praying to the God of heaven with what was on the line there. If we would, let's turn forward to the 4th chapter of Nehemiah, and we'll look at another example of a short prayer. Nehemiah, the 4th chapter, verses 4 and 5. And this is one of those cases where we look at there's a lot of intrigue going on, and there are some powerful figures there that are already, you know, in the area of Jerusalem that have assignments in the role of governors. There's some powerful, influential people, and they're adversarial to Nehemiah. And this takes place basically throughout the book of Nehemiah. There's these constant probes, the maneuverings, the letters from different people back to the king, to King Artaxerxes, to make accusations and to put Nehemiah in the worst light possible. So there's some of this going on by a character named Sanballat. We don't know if that's an office or if that is an individual's name. And there's also the mention of an individual named Tobiah. And both of these men are very adversarial to Nehemiah. So when you look at that account, we get down here and here's what Sanballat's doing. Here's what Tobiah is saying. And they're making some really accusative comments about, you know, this wall building project that the Jews have got going on there. And then, you know, in right in the middle of the dialogue in verse 4, then Nehemiah hauls off and says, hear, O our God, for we're despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Verse 5, do not cover their iniquity. Do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they've provoked you to anger before the builders. So Nehemiah is a little bit aggravated here, and he's asking God, you know, God, don't forget what these guys are doing. You know, step in here and help us, you know, nullify their efforts. You know, save us here because these people are powerful and they are armed and they're adversarial. So that Nehemiah, right in the middle of that, you know, then he continues in verse 6, so we built the wall, you know. But right there in that inset, those two verses, there's that short, succinct little prayer to God for, you know, God, remember what these guys are doing. Remember the problems that they're causing us, and that in that sense, and the affront that that is to you, the Creator. Let's turn over a page or so to the fifth chapter, 19th verse, Nehemiah 5 and verse 19. So he's got a lengthy account here, and then right at the end of the chapter, then he says something that is not in the context, you know, of the account that he's given. And he's talking about, you know, we didn't eat the governor's provisions while we were there, and he's dealing with this and that problem, this or that challenge. And then in 19, he says, remember me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. And he's imploring God, please don't forget, you know, the efforts that I'm putting forth on your behalf and for your purposes, your plan. You know, please don't forget that. Please don't forget me in that. Remember me, my God, for good. I think that's, to me, it's an intriguing thought, intriguing question in the context of all that was going on at the time. Now then over across the page in many cases to the sixth chapter, ninth verse, Nehemiah 6 and verse 9. And so there's some Sanballat is added again. He is trying to get Nehemiah to meet with him, and basically it's an ambush. It's going to be an ambush, and Nehemiah is wise to that. But in verse 9, then he says this, They all were trying to make us afraid, saying, their hands will be weakened in the work, and it'll not be done. So that's a really good encapsulation of here's what Sanballat, Tobiah, and others were doing to try to disrupt the efforts of the work on the wall. And then Nehemiah says at the end of that verse, now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. And you can see the situation that he was in and the challenges that he was facing pretty much on every side. And he says, O God, strengthen my hands. I need some strength. I need some help here. A one line, you know, what short little prayer. Undoubtedly a very heartfelt prayer. And then in the same chapter in verse 14, there's more about Sanballat and Tobiah, and then Nehemiah's prayer in verse 14 is, my God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and remember the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. We've got quite a number of people with the subterfuge going on that they are trying to do whatever they can to distract, to delay, to disrupt the work on the wall there and the restoration of Jerusalem from the damage that it suffered when Jerusalem was captured. But God, don't forget these two guys and that prophetess as well. There's not much said that I know of about the role of the prophetess elsewhere other than just the mention of her by name. But all of them are described as they're trying to undermine this effort. Now then, finally, let's turn over to the 13th chapter of Nehemiah. And this particular chapter has four different verses where there are four different places where there are these short prayers. And different subjects, obviously, but four places where there's the small or the short prayers. Nehemiah, the 13th chapter, and let's start in verse 14. And he's just gotten through the account of he has returned to Babylon at the king's request because he wasn't released permanently to go to Jerusalem and stay there. So he asked the king, you know, for time to go with the provision that he would return. Well, he's gone back, and while he's away, there's been all kinds of other things going on. One of the priests that should have been faithful and was thought to be faithful actually was was connected with Tobiah, and he was an informer. And then also, this individual permitted Tobiah to move some stuff into the temple, the house of God. And when Nehemiah heard that, he was really, really upset. And so then he comes back from Babylon to Jerusalem. He sees all this stuff, and he starts taking care of it. In 13 verse 14, then he says this, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out my good deeds that I've done for the house of my God and for the offices thereof." Right in the middle of all of this account of what he was dealing with, he's reaching out to God, basically, you know, asking to be remembered for his efforts. And then down in verse 22, and this is part of what he was doing to, you know, to get this mess taken care of and to deal with merchants that are bringing goods into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. And when he closes the gates, they're coming up to the wall. He's basically trying to get that situation under control. And in that section, he says this in verse 22, "And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves or consecrate themselves, and that they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy." I'm not sure why he was asking or why he brought it up in that particular way, but he's certainly imploring God for intervention on his behalf. And then in verse 29, he'll write the last couple of verses in the book. And then prior to that, let's start in 28. "One of the sons of Joada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was the son-in-law of Sanballat." So you've got this marriage into a non-Israelite family, and you've got that conduit of information between, you know, the office of the priest and this adversary named Sanballat the Horonite. "Therefore, I drove him from me." So he finally took care of Eliashib. "Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites." He's basically, asking for God's intervention for what has been done by this particular priest and his family. And then finally in verse 31, then the very last short prayer in the book, "Remember me, O my God, for good. Remember me, O my God, for good." I want to just mention four areas that we might consider where short prayers might be very appropriate. The first one, it's like Nehemiah, when we're suddenly in a situation where we need God's wisdom, we need tact, we need discretion, and we don't have any preparation time. And, you know, some of those examples that, you know, I know that many of you have experienced, we've all experienced them in one form or another. Might have been you witnessed the confrontation in a customer service line in a store or something like that, and you wonder, well, what should I do in this situation? What's the appropriate response? But when we don't have the time to do the preparation, then that's a case where a short prayer may be very appropriate, where we need wisdom, we need help, we need guidance, we need forbearance, we need patience, whatever it is that we can very quickly and silently cry out to God for his help, you know, in that. Second area is like the individual mentioned in the introduction, we suddenly need immediate help for protection for ourselves when there is an imminent threat. You know, in the case of the father and his son, that wasn't, he just had, you know, just seconds at most to see that situation develop, know that there's nothing he could do physically to intercede or intervene in this, and he cries out to God, and God answered that prayer. So when we find ourselves in the same situation, some of us may have been through dangerous situations you know, here this past week with, you know, electrical outages, trees that are damaged, you know, whatever it may have been, that, you know, we need some protection right here and right now. And that's a good case for, you know, a short prayer to God for, you know, for his intervention for us. I think the last couple of areas have a different point of emphasis, a different focus. I think we can do so in thanksgiving, recognizing that God, you know, has provided us with deliverance, and that maybe we've done something where we miscalculated a risk, and that thankfully it turned out well for us. That there is an opportunity, I believe, to give God immediate thanks for, you know, his intervention and his sparing us injury or death or whatever in a circumstance, some of the circumstances like we've been in last week. And then finally, I think an area that we can use short prayers where they're appropriate is an appreciation of the beauty of God's creation. Some of you may be on one of the many different lists that COGWA has, and Tom Clark has one. I don't know what it's called, but there will be a weekly article that's published. And his most recent one was on appreciating the beauty that God has created. He doesn't make this point about giving thanksgiving, certainly not in this context, but certainly looking at and appreciating, you know, the power and the beauty and the wisdom of the Creator that we can see, you know, all around us. And I think that that's a good case, a good opportunity for us to express our thanks in a very short prayer. And we certainly, you know, we can do so in, you know, much more detail and over a much longer period of time in prayer. So this is not by any means, you know, something that is exclusive to, you know, other prayers at other times. But, you know, when we're, you know, to recap this, you know, just very briefly, when we have an immediate need for wisdom, for discretion, for tact, that's a good case. We have an immediate need for protection in the face of an imminent threat. And where we have the opportunity in thanksgiving to immediately express that thanksgiving to God, and where we also can, in appreciation of the beauty of God's creation. Today we've taken a look at a few examples of short or small prayers in the Bible and the circumstances surrounding them. Where applicable, we may have the same needs at different times, and hopefully we can resort to the same techniques that we see as scriptural examples in the Bible. And finally, I'd like to invite any of you, because these are by no means an exhaustive list. If you have examples of short prayers that you would care to share with me, I would very much appreciate that. Or if you have recollection of different scriptural accounts that I did not include, I'd really like to know about those. So if you're so inclined, I'd really appreciate the feedback.